I'm looking forward to hearing some new ideas and some things that we can use, and so we'll turn the time over to Dan.
Before we get started, I don't know about you, but I thought yesterday morning was one of the most emotional mornings that I experienced, because I believe that young man that was up here that went through that prison deal, do you know what I'm talking about? Troy Evans. You know, God must have special plans for him, because I can't imagine anybody tolerating what he did and coming out of it the way he did. And it was just a sensational thing. But in the process of my story, anybody ever go down a squirrel trail or a rabbit trail? You know how this works. You're going down the main trail, and you see the rabbit trail, and down you go. And you never make it back to the main path. Anybody ever do that?
Yeah.
Well, I did that yesterday. I didn't finish a story. Let me finish a story. This was a story about a businessman that I sold some health insurance to when he had two employees.
And he was a real genius,
and he's a franchise genius, and he built his business nationwide, even all the way to Japan, and went from a few thousand annual revenue to $110 million in about 15 years. And when he got to 500 employees, there were so many layers of management between him and me that I didn't get to talk to him very much. And one day I went in, and we were working on renewing their employee benefit plan that I was taking care of. And the CFO walked in, and he said, "Hey, Dan," he said, "are you going to get in a bid on our Key Man Life Insurance?" And I said, "No, I hadn't heard about it." He said, "Well, you better give the president a call. We're going to buy $10 million of Key Man Life Insurance." And 25 years ago, that's a big sale for me today, by the way, but it was a really big sale 25 years ago. So I called and, of course, talked to several layers of management to get 15 minutes with the company president. And he agreed to see me because he said, "Dan, you've done a good job with our group medical, but I think we've pretty well decided what we're going to do." And so the day came for my 15 minutes, and I went into his office, and his secretary ushered me into his office, and I think I described it to you yesterday. It was a huge office, and it was divided by this tropical fish salt water. And but on the right side was his desk, and it really looked like a little aircraft carrier. It was so big. And he stood up and greeted me warmly, shook my hand, and gestured for me to sit at the guest chair, and I sat down, and he asked me about my family and how my business was, and we had a nice little chat, and then it came time to talk about business. And I noticed while we were talking that there was a pile of proposals on the edge of his desk, way down on the end of this aircraft carrier. Big pile of proposals. And with the educated life insurance eye, I knew what kind of proposals those were. Well, anyway, we got to the end of our little conversation, and he said, "Well, I know you're here to talk about the Key Man Life Insurance." And he smiled at me, and he looked over at the proposals, which he had very carefully piled up every one he could find on the end of this desk. And he pointed at the proposals, and he said, "Dan," he said, "what can you possibly tell me that I haven't already heard?" And that question said to me that he didn't want to waste any time and probably had already made up his mind at what he was going to do. And frankly, I was pretty certain there was probably nothing that I could tell him that he hadn't already heard. And so I said that to him. I said, "There's probably nothing I can tell you, but I would like to ask you a question. What do you do when you get in trouble?" And this morning for 2 hours, I'm going to tell you some questions that I learned to ask people that caused them to open their eyes a little wider, sit forward in their chair. What kind of a signal is it when somebody does that? Yeah, I call it a buying signal. You know, you like to see if somebody's interested, right? Well, the deal was, he's looking at me, and he's gesturing at this big pile of proposals, and I'm saying to him, there's probably nothing that I can tell you that you haven't already heard, but I would like to ask you a question. And he said, what's that? And I said, how would you like to be remembered? And he said, what do you mean? In your lifetime, has anybody ever done anything for you that causes you to remember them? And it set off about an hour and a half conversation. First of all, how his father helped him with a down payment on their house, then a down payment on a business building. I really want you to know this story because this is one of the luckiest things that ever happened to me. What place was I in when I went in there when he's saying I've got 67 proposals here? I was in last place. And anyway, he started telling me about his father, what his father had done for him. And then he sat back, you know, and he put his hands on his chin and he really started thinking. And I said, well, I'd like to help you create the same kind of thing so that if you're taken out of the picture, that the people you love and care about will be able to have the resources that they need to do the things that you think are really important for them. And so he continued to tell me about his three children and about his wife. And I said, can I take notes? And he said, sure. So I start taking notes. And I'm really taking a lot of notes. And an hour and a half later, he's told me about all of his hopes and dreams for a lifetime. And the strangest thing happened after this was all over. Here's what happened. And one thing you young people need to know, selling is not telling. Selling is listening. And in order to listen, you've got to ask good questions so that people will talk to you. Not just about the weather, but what's in their heart? What do they care about? What are they willing to die for? What's their life really about? What are their hopes and their dreams? And when people do that, you know what? There's a bonding that takes place. It's never going to be the same again. Your life with that person is going to be different. Well, after telling me for an hour and a half to 2 hours about all of his hopes and dreams and me taking notes, he looked over at me and he said, I'd like you to help me with something. And he stood up and he started to walk down to the pile of proposals and I walked down there too. And at the end of this aircraft carrier was a waste basket. And he said, help me. And we dumped all the proposals into the waste basket. True story. Now, had we talked about concepts or facts or figures or ledger statements or in companies, we hadn't even talked about premiums. Why did he do that? I mean, I didn't say anything to him. What was I doing? Taking notes. I was sitting there listening. And he was telling me, and you know, it's an interesting thing. In my lifetime, whenever anybody's told me their life story like that, when they're finished telling it, sometimes I'll say to them, can I ask you a question? What's that? Have you told anybody else this story? Do you know what they tell you? They say no. Nobody ever asked. Or yeah, I told my wife or my spouse. Now, I want you to really consider this. Most of the people that you call on, maybe 90% of them, maybe even 100% of them, that you will call on during your lifetime, nobody has taken the time and the interest to ask them about their hopes and dreams and to tell their life story. Nobody really cares. What they want to do is sell them whatever it is they sell and get out of there. And when somebody comes along who's decided that everybody else is more important than they are because they view themselves as a servant, and they want to know, hey, what's important to you? What do you care about? I mean, people don't need life insurance. What they need is to keep their families and their business together. What they need is to reach the family goals. And if life insurance can help them do that, then they do need life insurance. But before we talk about product, we've got to talk about what's your life really all about. And what I learned at a very young age, and I was lucky, I stumbled onto this. When people tell you what they really care about, when they pour their heart out to you, there is a bond that forms, and it's called trust. And when that begins to happen, you are in a different mode with people. And that's when they're ready to do something. Well, long story short, he told me during this hour and a half that he wanted $1 million for each of his three kids held in trust and $2 million for his wife. I got the $10 million Key Man life insurance sale, and I got a $5 million irrevocable life insurance trust sale. $15 million worth of life insurance. And I didn't have a proposal. He had never looked at one. Isn't that interesting? What can we learn from this? And just to review it, you saw yesterday I showed the picture of the guy on the boat and then him being taken out of the picture. You remember that? I mean, this really means something to people. When you ask the question, what happens if you get taken out of the picture? I mean, what would it be like if in your home suddenly you're taken out of the picture? Does anything change? Or does everything stay the same? What happens? And when people really start thinking about that, then they realize, I would have a problem. My family would have a problem if I'm taken out of the picture. And what happens when people begin to discover there's a problem? See, we're supposed to talk to people about their problems, not about our products. And the more we talk about the problem, the more people begin to feel the pain of what the consequence is if this problem comes to fruition. And when they realize that we have a product that can take care of the problem, paying the premium is not a problem anymore. And the more you talk about the problem, the more people feel the pain of the problem. And the more they feel the pain of the problem, the less they're concerned about the cost. But guess what happens if you turn this around the other way and you come in and talk about your product? All people think about is cost. And the more you talk about your product, no matter how good it is, the more they think, I wonder if there's another product out there that costs less than yours does or that's better. And so the more you talk about solutions, the more people are cost conscious. But the more you talk about the problem, the more they're concerned about solving the problem and the cost goes away. Does that make sense? So what should we be talking about? You know, I asked an audience once, what business are we in? Are we in the business of selling solutions or solving problems? And most of them said, we sell solutions. Well, if you sell solutions, the focus is going to be on cost. If you sell problems, the focus is going to be on solving the problem. So what business are we in? And how do you find out what the problem is? You got to, and not only do you have to ask the question, they've got to tell you, and you've got to ask good questions so that they really think about, you know, it's possible that I could be taken out of the picture. Either I die or I can't work anymore. You know, one thing you learn as an old geezer, you notice the geezerism here? When somebody gets disabled, I didn't know this when I was young. I thought, well, the husband got disabled, we send him a check, right? When somebody gets disabled, in most marriages, both people are disabled. Did you know that? Because what happens is the spouse has to be home taking care of their spouse, and so neither one of them can work. Or they're so concerned about their spouse, they can't think well enough to do good work. Last March, my attorney's wife got pancreatic cancer. And she was in terrible pain. And he used to tell me, you know, he'd go home at lunchtime and just watch her lying in bed in pain. And it got so bad he could hardly go to work. He did everything he could to try to make life comfortable for her. But for 5 or 6 months, he was worthless as far as being able to do his work because he was so concerned about his wife. And I began to realize, you know, we don't know what it's like when somebody else gets disabled, what's going on with the party, their spouse that is not disabled. There are a lot of problems that people don't see until suddenly they come around a corner and something really serious has happened. Unless you and I are able to sit down with them and reason, let's look to the future and consider what could happen to your family, you being the breadwinner, what could happen to your family if you're taken out of the picture? Now, how can you get taken out of the picture? You could die. You could become disabled. You could lose your competence, lose your ability to have a job. There's a lot of ways you can be taken out of the picture. My job is to try to help you come up with a plan so that if you are taken out of the picture, we're going to be prepared for it. And it's got to be part of your financial plan. You notice this little guy up here? This is what I call the cardinal rule. This is what my life is about teaching this. Spend less and you earn. That's the cardinal rule of financial planning. Does it matter how much you earn? Because if you spend every dime that you earn and all you can borrow, where are you? Do you have any idea the condition, debt-wise, that this country is in as far as individuals and credit cards are concerned? You know, I happen to be in an area here in Utah where I think people pay real close attention to this. So this is a little bit like preaching to the choir, I suspect. But I will tell you this. The reason people don't have time to be good family members and they don't have time to pursue their spiritual life is because they're so wrapped up trying to pay their credit card debt and so wrapped up paying for all the stuff they bought that they didn't need that they can't think about family. I mean, they got 2-3 jobs. Why? You know, I remember when we lived in a house that didn't have a garage. It was a little carriage house down over the hill. And then they built this new house with a garage in it. Man, this is something. And then 2 garages, 3 garages. I mean, you know what? If you can't afford 2 cars, you ought to have 1. And if you can't afford 2, you ought to have none. There's nothing the matter with riding bikes and going on the bus. The truth of the matter is we can figure out how to spend less than we learn. It's just that we don't want to do it. We just don't want to do it. And sometimes what we've got to do is be the catalyst to help people understand why less is better than more. You know, if everybody you come in contact with in your life, you can teach them how to live within their means. You will give them a freedom so that they can be good family members and they can pursue their spiritual life. In my view, all that we learn about finances, 3rd is about as high as you can get it on the list. 2nd is family, and 1st is your spiritual life because it drives everything you do. So, even though you may not necessarily feel that way, I feel like I'm a missionary in life because I'm out there trying to help people get control of their finances. Because if they can do that, then they can lead the life that they're supposed to be leading. Does that make sense? And that's why I talk to them about this. Well, let's move on into some, as Ken said, some cartoons. One day, I try to teach people to save money all my life. Try to teach my sons that. And frankly, they learned it pretty well. I had one kid graduate from college with no debt and $20,000 in invested capital, and he was 21 years old. He's now a partner with KPMG, which is astonishing to me. I mean, sometimes people feel the parents make the kids look good. Well, not at my house. The kids make the parents look good. Anyway, one day a friend of mine told me about cash cows. I said, what is a cash cow? He said, well, that's a cow that you go to get cash from instead of milk. And he said, you know, you ought to have about 6 of those. And he was talking about real estate being a cash cow and stocks and bonds being a cash cow and your business being a cash cow. And I thought to myself, why don't I use cash cows instead of talking to people about saving money? And the cows out here in Utah say moo, right? Well, one of my friends in the home office sent me a picture one day of a cow that said moolah. Moolah. So here we have a cow. Well, this is a question that I used for the first 30 years I was in business working with young people. And one day I'm talking to a fella 65 years old and telling him about this. And he got really excited, and I wondered why he did, because he was 65 years old and very successful. And he said, the reason is I want you to get all of my grandkids in here and tell them this story. And it was about this. If you save the same amount of money the next 5 years as you did the last 5 years, are you going to be happy with the results? What do most people say? What does that mean? They want to do better, right? So I show them this. Everybody's first cash cow is their job, where they work, their source of income. Here we have two men, could be two women, but here we have two men, Smith and Jones, and they're both getting their monthly allotment pumped into their checking account, and we depict that as a bucket. Smith is really excited. You can see the smile on his face. He's already figured out what he's going to do with his money. And Jones is standing there with his checking account bucket, but what does he have under his arm? Plan. Well, Smith takes off, and what do all buckets do? They leak. Some of the milk of his hard work is already leaking out on the ground. And what kind of leaks do we have? Well, if you don't have a plan, you may pay more in taxes than you need to. That'll create a puddle. Smith liked anything with a motor in it. Motorboat, dune buggy, chainsaw. He also liked clothing with those little labels in there. What do you call those? Designer labels? And food. He always went to the grocery store when he was hungry. And did he have a list? Now there's trouble. A hungry man going to a grocery store with no list. And vacation, he always planned his vacation at the last moment. So he got to pay the highest price for it. So there's a lot of lost money that didn't have to be there. Too much tax, maybe hobbies that weren't very helpful to his family, spending more money on things that he needed. And when his wife looked in the bucket for money for the family's future, drawing on where's the beef, where's the milk for the family's future? Does this sound familiar? Incidentally, I showed this to a fellow once when I was making $25,000 a year. He was making $25,000 a month, and I was kind of afraid to show it to him because, I mean, in my mind, he was incredibly successful and I wasn't, and I'm talking to him about this, and at this very moment, he stopped me, and I'm really scared he's going to throw me out. And he pointed at this guy. Now, this guy made 12 times as much money as I do. Picture somebody making 12 times as much money as you do, and you show him this picture, and he's pointing at it and saying, that's me. I make a lot of money, and I can't hang on to it. Isn't that amazing? Simple little picture like that. You see, the more money you make, the more guilty you feel if you're not hanging on to some of it. Are people hanging on to some of it? Not without a little help. I mean, we got everybody in the world. I mean, can you imagine some guy signs a bonus contract and they give him $10 million or something? Do you think maybe somebody might be trying to relieve him of that money a little bit? I mean, he's got everybody in the world after him. He's got relatives he didn't even dream of. Names he did not know. Well, here's Jones. Jones knew that the key to hanging on to money and making it work right for him is at the moment that you get your paycheck, you have a plan. First thing he did is he put money in savings. Ben Franklin was famous for saying, pay yourself first. So he did. Put 10, 20% in savings. In his plan, he also had a budget. Now, we don't use the word budget because people hate the word budget. Usually if you say, how's your budget, most people get a little pain right in the abdomen, right? So we don't call it a budget. What we call it is a written down spending plan. So I'd ask my client, do you have a written down spending plan? He'd say, well, no, it's in my head. Does it count if it's in your head? No. So I say to him, who do you think does better in life? People with a written down spending plan or people that don't have one? Would you like me to help you come up with a written down spending plan? I mean, 90% of the people that you will talk to, young man, won't have a written down spending plan. Who do you think does better in life? If I can teach him to pay himself first and have a written down spending plan, will he get more mileage out of his money? Will it free him up a little bit? Maybe keep him away from drowning in credit card debt? You know, the average person in America has got $16,000 worth of credit card debt and 9 cards. That's the average. How does something get to be an average? See those little tiny cows? What do you call a little tiny cow?
Calf.
If you feed a calf milk, what does it grow into someday? What's the milk of a savings account?
Interest.
You feed the interest into a mutual fund or some little annuity or something, what's it going to grow into someday? A cash cow. And if in your budget you figure out a few things that you can feed some of your income to, what's that going to grow into? When you get enough money in your savings account so that when you turn the spigot, there's a little pressure on the spigot there, it'll allow you maybe to go into business for yourself, buy some real estate, make some investments, buy some insurance. Bottom line is this, you can end up like Smith crying over spilt milk, or if you're like Jones, you got some money in savings, eventually you went into business for yourself, you made some investments, real estate, stocks, bonds, from your budget you bought some disability insurance, some life insurance, some mutual funds. What was the difference between Smith and Jones? He had a plan. How long did it take me to show you that? If you were to show that to somebody that didn't have a plan, didn't have a written down spending plan, wasn't paying themselves first, do you think they might get interested in that? So I've showed it to thousands of people. You know, now that you've seen this, how much you think you might be able to save a month? $50 a month, $100, $200, $300? Start someplace, right? Which do you think is easier, showing them these 6 pictures in 6 or 8 minutes, or like I used to do, 3 hours of boring them to death and their eyes are clouded over? And that's why, like Ken said, we try to develop concepts or pictures. The rule of 72, isn't that a fun thing to do? How many of you do that? I called on the president of a college one day, smartest person I've ever met, and I said, by the way, are you familiar with the rule of 72? And she said, yeah, but run it by me again. Because people aren't doing this every day, are they? And when you show them the rule of 72, you know, if they're in their 30s or something like that, and their money can double and double and double, what's zero doubled? You know, so they begin to think, maybe I better pile up some so I've got something to double, right? Interesting. When I was in my early 50s, it suddenly dawned on me that everything I had was going to double before I was age 65. Then all of a sudden, this was a nice number. But if you can show people, you know, in 8 years it doubles, and then it's double 4, and then it's 8, and then it's 16, it shows people the great ally of any saver is what?
Time.
How about the effect of compounding? Now, see the little peppermint or the stripe at the bottom? This is the money you put in. Guess what the green is? Growth. Think of green for growth. You know, green leaves, growth. Now, this little example is somebody putting $150 a month in and earning a total rate of return of 9% per year. The rate of return is somewhat unimportant, but what I want to show you is this. Look at the 15 years. When you get out to 15 years, the green is the same size as the peppermint. In other words, for each dollar you put in 15 years, how much have you earned? A dollar. So you got a dollar for dollar. Let's say at the end of 15 years, you decided, you know, I think I'm going to buy a new boat. So you took your money out and bought a new boat. But what if instead you said, you know, I'm not going to buy a new boat. I'm going to leave it in for another 5 years. Notice that in 20 years, you got $2 for every dollar you put in. So the next 5 years, you accumulated as much as you did the first 15. Well, what if we go to 25 years, we get 4 to 1. The next 5 years, we accumulated as much in 5 years as we did in 20. And the next 5 years, we accumulated as much in 5 years as we did in 25 years. What's the message here? Compounding creates a catapult. It literally catapults the growth. What's the key to this is starting early, right? I used to carry 15, 20 for you young folks. I'm interested in young people, by the way. 15, 20 of these I'd carry around in my briefcase. If I could spend 3 to 4 minutes with somebody, I could sit down and show that to them. And you know what? Nobody else showed it to them. And they'd look at that. And remember when Ford used to have the ad, F-O-R-D, and they'd pull the switch and the O would turn into a light bulb? Remember Ford had a better idea? You know? Sometimes when you show somebody a picture like this, the light bulb goes on. They learn something. Life is about learning. Life is about growing. People need ideas. Ideas energize people. That one little picture, I've shown it thousands of times, somebody look at that and say, man, I never thought about that. You mean if I can go 20 years, I'll get double what I accumulated the first 15? People don't get these ideas from Money Magazine and CNN. They get them from you. Especially if they can tell you're doing it and you believe in it. Because if you're not doing it and you don't believe in it, they know it, don't they? Here's Investor A and Investor B. Investor A put in $150 a month for 10 years, $1,800 a year, total $18,000. Let it ride to age 65. At 9%, it's over $400,000. 35-year-old investor put in the same $150 a month, $1,800 a year for 30 years. Three times as much money, $54,000, ended up with less than $300,000. What do you think happens when you show that to people your age? What do you think happens you show that to a couple hundred people your age? Do you think they know that? They're walking around with this information? They aren't. And if you take the time to show them, and incidentally, I've showed this to 62-year-old guys too, because they've got children and grandchildren. And they want them to know this because when you're 62, you think, you know, if I'd have been a little smarter when I was 35 years old, like this young fellow here, you're not 35 yet though, are you? But that's okay, you will be someday. But these pictures tell a message. So they tell stories, don't they? Let me tell you a story, so you show them a picture. Successful people set aside money regularly, they put their money to work. They leave it alone to work for them. They prepare for death and disability. It takes discipline. There are your cash cows, income, saving, life insurance, disability insurance, retirement annuities, investment real estate, bond funds, stock funds, retirement plans, deferred comp. What are all these things? Cash cows. Which do you think people would rather have, cash cows or a deferred comp plan? You know? I mean, it feels good, doesn't it? It gives you a good gut feeling. And it talks in a way that people can understand. Should your financial plan be balanced? Protection, saving, investment? Do we have limited resources? I remember the time my boys were studying in the dining room with all their friends. My house was Boys Town. And I learned an easy way to track all the boys in the neighborhood, and we had a lot of fun. Feed them. They like food. And I learned how to feed boys, and man, they're all out there studying. And they're studying about math and economics, and they had heard about Donald Trump. And they were all really excited. They had this book, Trump. You know, and they said, Mr. Corrigan, what do you think of Mr. Trump? And I said, well, it looks like he's doing pretty good. And he said, he's the greatest. I said, wait a minute. Understand this. No matter how big you are, you can fall. Trump is just a man. And 1 year later, Trump had a minus net worth, which was kind of amazing. He doesn't seem to have one now. He needs a little new hairdo thing, but... But the next year, the boys were studying. They said, Mr. Corrigan, how did you know? And I said, I didn't know. But I said, don't forget, there are things more important than just spending all your life chasing finances. But you have to understand there's discipline required. And, you know, my boys learned from that. But we all have limited resources. We can't put it all into investments. We can't put it all into saving. We can't put it all into protection. How do we balance this? Well, one day I met the father of financial planning down in Los Angeles, Gene Hanch. And Gene had this little sailboat, and I asked him if I could use it. And he said, sure. And I said, you mind if I make some changes to it? And he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, that little boat you have doesn't have a rudder, and I think every boat ought to have a rudder. He says, go right ahead and do it. Well, I decided to start showing my people, comparing the running of a little sailboat with the running of your family financial plan. And here goes. What does it take to have a sailboat? Got to have a sail. Got to have a place to sit. We call that the hull. And you got to have a life ring in case you spring a leak, right? So we decided we would designate the sail for investments. So when you think of the sail maker, think of investments, equities, real estate, business, and so forth. And then the hull, the place where you sit, we decided to designate that as savings or bank or something like that, money market, cash. And then the life ring, guess what we decided to designate the life ring? Insurance. Okay? So here's what we decided to do. Three scenarios. Go to the investment guy and have him design a boat for you. Go to the banker in the cash business, have him design a boat for you, sailboat. And number three, go to the insurance guy and have him design a little boat for you. Well, here's what happened when they went to the investment guy. Gigantic sail, little tiny hull. Now, this little boat, when the financial seas are just right and the markets are just right, this little boat sails through rippity, just ripping through the sea, going real fast. But what happens when the wind stops? Is this hull big enough to balance this sail? So what's likely to happen? It's going to capsize. The danger is it could capsize. What happens when something capsizes? Do you start back where you started from, or do you start in the hole? You don't even have a boat now, do you? Next, we went to the banker and asked him to design a boat for us. Now, what business is a banker in? Saving. So here we got a gigantic hull. This sucker is really stable. What's the problem with this boat? It won't go anywhere. In the vernacular, if you throw your money under a mattress and inflation causes everything to go up in cost, your purchasing power is going to be lost over time, isn't it? And then we went to the life ring provider. Who's that? And we asked the insurance guy to design a sailboat for it. This is what we got. Gigantic life ring, little tiny hull, little tiny sail, not very stable. What's the problem with this boat? It only works if it sinks. Now, my grandmother always told me, you know, don't ever put any money in the stock market. But when we went to the investment guy, they said, put all your money in the stock market. When we went to the banker, he says, put all your money in the bank. And amazingly, some people say, you know, when I talk to my insurance man, he says, put everything into insurance. And I know there's something the matter with this information. Well, here's the answer, is a well-balanced program. A sale investment program that's big enough to take you where you want to go to get your family goals reached, but a hull big enough to counterbalance this sale so that when times are bad, there's enough cash. When you're not working or you're unemployed or business isn't good, there's enough cash to take you through the bad times. And then also a life ring in case you spring a leak that would be big enough to take care of the number of people on board. Does that make sense? What's missing from this boat? A rudder. What's the rudder? Rudder is the plan. A sailboat goes no place without a rudder. You're not going to go any place without a plan. The rudder equals the plan. Tell me about your plan. How long did it take me to show you that? When I would meet a prospect, I'd say, before we talk today, I got a 5-minute little thing I want to show you, and I showed him that. Now, the reason I did is because when I got to this point, I'd say, well, tell me about your plan. What do you think they said? They don't have a plan. Or they would say, well, that's what I have you here for. That'd be good news after 5 minutes, right? I had a young fella. One day I was going to speak in Vancouver, Washington, and he called me up on the phone and he said, Dan, he said, I'm failing in business and I was wondering if I could visit with you after the meeting. And after the meeting, I showed this to him. And I said, I want you to promise me for the next 2 months, the first thing you're going to do to everybody you call on is show them this and then talk to them. And that young man opened more business. He not only didn't fail in the business, the next year he led his company in the state of Washington. Because he had something to show people. You see, people need to see things. These pictures, I can't draw anything. I had to have people draw all these pictures for me. But people look at a picture and their IQ is 4 times higher than normal. Because your mind will look at a picture and it'll try to figure out what is it? What does it mean? Does that make sense? Now, these are simple things. If you can't use these, maybe somebody you know that can use them. This is the other basic that we talked about yesterday. One generation ago, when people retired, if their income was substantially higher than their expenses, life was good. But which way did the expenses go? Up or down? Always up. Sometimes faster, sometimes slower, but always up. But 30 years ago, when people were dying after 7 years in retirement, what happened before their expenses were greater than their income? They died. What happens today? People are living longer and longer and longer and longer. In fact, probably 20 years longer, maybe 25 years longer. And sooner or later, if your income is a flat line, what's going to happen if you live long enough? What happens is people start liquidating assets. What happens to your income when you start liquidating assets? Goes down, gets even worse, till eventually you have people who have no money, and they're 84 years old. What do they do? What if they met you when they were in their 50s or 60s, and you said, you know, this is what we want to do. We want to create an increasing stream of income so that no matter whether you live to be 80, 100, 120, that as long as your income increase each year is greater than your expenses, this is income after taxes, you'll always be able to protect your purchasing power. How do you think we do this? Incidentally, most financial planners out our way, when they're planning for retirement, they'll sit people down and they start off with saying, well, we're going to assume that you're going to live to be age 85. And so when you reach age 85, we are going to spend the last dollar you have. Sounds like a good plan, right? And then there's a guy that wanders out to the mailbox to catch his bills, and he's age 86. How does this plan work when you're 86? What's the fastest growing age group in the country today? Over age 100. Somebody ought to call the Social Security Administration for the next year's Grant Taggart Symposium and find out how many people over age 100 got a check from the Social Security Administration in the year 2007? I know that it was at least 4,000 people. But sometimes, I'd be a bad witness, by the way, sometimes I add zeros to things. And unless somebody calls you on it, you know, it works. I'm not sure whether it was 4,000 people last year or 40,000. It's a big number. But over 4,000 people in the year 2007 got a check from Social Security that were over age 100. What's the rate of inflation in our country over the last 70 years? 3.5% is what people publish. Do you know if you need $3,000 to pay your bills now and you live 30 years, Do you know how much you have to pay those $3,000 worth of bills 30 years from now at 3.5%? I notice we don't agree. The answer is $9,000. So let's say somebody retires at age 60 and they got a nice income. They're back here with one of these deals. Their expenses are much less than their income. But they got $3,000 worth of bills. And they're 60. And now they're age 90. And they say to you, "I never expected to live this long." They all say that, the ones that are alive. The ones that aren't alive, they don't get to say that. But the 90-year-old says, "I never expected to live this long." And those bills that used to be $3,000, they're now $9,000. And guess what? My income hasn't gone up. What can I do about it? Well, what you can do about it is meet somebody in this room when you were 60. Because the answer is, you must take less than what your retirement assets are going to produce so that your principal grows each year, right? Let's say you had $1 million and you earned 9%. What's 9% of a million? 90,000. Let's say you took 45,000 of income and you left 45,000 in. How much do you have now? 1,045,000. So in year two, you could take 4.5% of 1,045,000, which gives you a couple hundred dollars a month extra, right? Wouldn't that create an increasing level of income over time? Do you see what I'm saying? The point is, if you don't draw all the income that your retirement assets produce, if you take half of it or even less than half of it, your principal is going to grow every year. The only way your income's going to go up during retirement is if your principal does what? How do you get your principal to go up? Spend less than you earn. We used to think the cardinal rule is for young people. You young folks, you've got to spend less than you earn. But us old folks, we don't have to do that. We can spend all we earn. That is a lie. The cardinal rule is true for a 60-year-old, a 70-year-old, an 80-year-old, a 90-year-old. You must spend less than you earn. And if you do, guess what happens to your principal? It goes up. It goes up. And if you don't tell people that, where are they going to find it out? Let me ask you this. Have you seen those two lines any other place lately? And if this is the first time you've seen it, do you think your clients have seen this? I'm going to tell you, they haven't. I've been at it 46 years. I know they haven't. You've got some news for them that they need to learn. And there's another bit of news they need to learn too. This country can't afford having everybody retired living from age 60 to 100 and have Medicare, Social Security, and I don't know what all else. We can't afford it. And frankly, we don't need to afford it because we've learned if you eat right, exercise right, get the proper amount of rest and lead the right kind of life, you ought to be able to work till you're 75 or 85. Now, you say that to somebody and they say, "Man, I hate my job. I'm burned out." Yeah, but what if you only had to work 20 hours a week or 6 months out of the year and you could get a third of your income so you wouldn't put all this pressure on your retirement? I've got all kinds of people now that I've been able to help go back and work another 10 or 15 years but do it 6 months out of the year. They love it. Gives them a place to go. One of my best clients is a mortician. And he'll tell you something. It's not enough just to have money. You can have several $1 million, but if you don't have something to do in retirement, guess what happens? You're very unhappy. Man was not made to sit on his rear. We were made to do something. And there's lots out there to do that we can have fun doing. But we need to rethink this. We need to repot ourselves when we're 60, 65 years old. And if we have these kind of frank conversations with people, spend less than you earn, find something constructive that you really want to do, you can earn some income and take the pressure off of your retirement. And what would happen as a nation if we did this? Would it be good or bad? And sooner or later we'll come to this decision. When I was a boy, every movie I went to, every person in the movie had a cigarette in their hand. Not all of them were smoking them, but you had to have a cigarette in your hand anyway. Until one day the AMA came out with a dictum, hey, this kills people. And the sign said, 354,618 members of the AMA quit smoking. What do they know that you ought to know? Well, one of these days we're going to have a poster saying, hey, you know, we need to rethink this thing about retirement. Incidentally, I've never noticed the word retirement in the Bible, did you? I mean, do things differently maybe, you know. Spend more time with your grandchildren. Do life differently. But retirement, that's an American invention. And it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. What does make sense is to think about what kind of a plan for my life can I do and help me implement it. You can teach people to create an increasing stream of income during retirement, and you can also take pressure off their retirement by having them. You know, what sense does it make? A guy makes $60 an hour, and 2 years after retirement, he decides to go to work at Walmart for $7 an hour. The fact is, what you've spent your whole life doing is what you're best prepared to do. And people will want to pay you $50, $60, $70 an hour for something that you really know a lot about. So why not figure a way to stay in your own field some way and repot yourself and earn a third of what you used to earn when you're 65, 70, 75? I'm here to tell you that I've got probably 75 clients that I've helped do this. And they're happy. And they've got 6 months out of the year to do things that they never could do before because they were working full time. Does that make sense? This is kind of interesting. The actual rate of return in a managed portfolio the last 15, 20 years is 15.2%. Bonds earn 9.1%. T-bills 5.8%. Guess what the average is for investors who did their own investing? 5.3%. Do you see that? Left to their own devices without help from you, without some kind of discipline, people just... And this is one of the reasons why Money Magazine and CNN is not enough. You need a trusted advisor. Dow Jones average. Would you agree that the stock market is a history of fluctuating prices? If I could show you a system that always will make you money as long as prices fluctuate, would you be interested? Kind of sounds like a slam dunk, doesn't it? I mean, if the history of the market is it always fluctuates, and this system always makes money if it fluctuates, do you think you ought to know about it? What's the system? Dollar cost averaging. There is a method for systematic investment that's designed to capitalize on stock market fluctuations called dollar cost averaging. It's designed and made for the little guy, for us young folks. Where'd that young fellow go that I was teasing a little bit? You know, when I had $50 a month, this is what you do. And let me show you what can happen here. Here's two companies, Company A and Company B. And they both started off selling at $50 a share. Company A, though, is like a rocket ship. And over 64 months went from $50 to $250 a share. Company B started out at $50 a share and promptly started losing ground, dropped in price down to as low as $5 a share, and at the end of 64 months got back to $50 a share. Which company do you think most Americans would want to own? A. Well, let's say that we put $200 a month in Company A and $200 a month in Company B, and then at the end of 64 months, let's sell them and see what happened. Now, when they start out at $50 a share and you put in $200, how many shares do you get? Now, with Company A, when it gets up to $100 and you send in $200, how many shares do you get? And 150 and two on and so on. With Company A, you end up with about 104 shares. Company B, you start off at $50 a share. When it drops down to $25 and you send in your 200, how many shares do you get? And when it gets down to $10 a share, 20, and $5 a share, 40. Well, I'm going fast with this. If you want to spend some time this afternoon, I'll go over it with you slowly. But here's what happens. Company A, you get 104 shares. You sell it at $250. You get $26,000. You put in $12,800, which is $200 a month for 64 months. So with Company A, that went from $50 to $250, you doubled your money in 64 months. That's pretty good, isn't it? $13,000 profit, $26,000, $12,000. But Company B, you ended up with 1,066 shares. So when you sold it for $50, you got $53,300, a $40,500 profit in Company B. How'd that happen? Now which company would you rather own? Now I want to tell you something. I've shown this thousands of times, particularly to young folks, because they've got the time to invest in it over time. Who would believe that if you put $200 a month for 64 months into Company A or Company B, that Company B would end up being a better deal? Incidentally, that little line there out in the Pacific Northwest, that reminds us of the ocean. And we call that a trough. The history of the stock market is really a history of Company B's. It's a history of troughs. As long as you invest every single month over a long period of time, periodically there's a trough. Now what happens when there's a trough? The price does what? Goes down. And if you're putting $200 a month in and it goes down, you scoop up a lot more, and you scoop up a lot more, and you scoop up a lot more. So what happens, you get down here, down the road, because of all that scooping, you end up with four times your money back rather than twice your money back. And yet, what is everybody looking for? They're looking for Company A's. They're looking for rocket ships. And there are not very many of them, are there? But there's lots of Company B's if you've got the time and the discipline to invest. Now, when the market's going down, making that scoop, that trough, you've got to understand and believe in what you're doing, because the price is going down, down, down. And unless your advisor tells you, look, this is what's going to happen, this is the way it works, you've got to hang in there and stay there, you're going to sell, aren't you? And you're going to turn paper losses into real losses. But if you stay in there, this is what happens. What do you think would happen if you took this chunk of paper and showed that to a couple hundred people every year during your career? What if you just showed it to your spouse and the people in your neighborhood and the people you know? So you see, they don't know about dollar cost averaging. They've seen it. Excuse me, they've heard of it, but they haven't seen it. They don't really know how it works. Incidentally, and my system was real simple. I believe in food. You know, a guy asked me, Dan, what's your favorite sport? Football, baseball, basketball? And I said, no, lunch is my favorite sport. And what I did in the business, I'd invite people in for lunch. And after 20 minutes, I would show this to them. I'd hand them a calculator, piece of paper, and have them write down the numbers. Why'd I do it? Why'd I have them write them down? You think they understand, but unless you have them write it down, you don't know if they understand. At the end of the time, when it was time for them to leave, guess what they did with a piece of paper? They folded it up, took it with them. Do you take things with you that you value or don't value? If they left it on the table, what'd I know? No value. If they took it with them, what did I know? They learned something that was of value to them, right? Guess how many people left a piece of paper on my conference room table over 40 years? It's a round number. Except one day, one lady was leaving the room, and I was crushed. She was going to be the first one to leave it on the table. And I said to her, is there anything you'd like to take with you? And I'm trying to get her to look back at the table. She says, oh, yeah. And she runs over and grabs the paper, took it. Sure glad of that, you know. Now, I'm telling you this because my first 10 years in the business was a terrible struggle. I got up at 5 in the morning, went to bed at midnight, worked on Saturday. I worked around the clock. It was a good thing they didn't count strokes because I was taking a lot of strokes. You know what I mean? The ball was not going in the hole. Until one day Roger Zehner said to me, you know, Dan, instead of boring people to death, why don't you buy yourself an overhead projector and show them concepts, show them pictures. And so once a month I met with a starving artist, and I would tell him my sales idea and have him draw 5 or 6 pictures. That's where the cash cow came from. That's where the sailboat came from. And then instead of boring people to death, I showed him the pictures. And then every time somebody had a great idea, I got this idea from a million-dollar roundtable meeting about dollar cost averaging, you know, and I've shown that thousands of times. I was telling Wayne Gledhill the other day, I had over 1,500 mutual fund customers putting $50 to $200 a month in. Now, in the beginning, that didn't seem like much. But one day, and it was a no-load fund, you know, I figured, why sell somebody a load fund if they're putting $50 a month in? What's 8% of $50? Zero. So why not give them a no-load fund so they're really excited about it? I'll sell the life insurance. I'll give them the no-load fund. Well, I had 1,500 people in this no-load fund. It's a really nice little fund. And one day the guy who owned the fund called me on the phone. He says, Dan, you realize you've got over $5 million in our fund now? And I said, no, I didn't. But he said, you know, and we like what you're doing. We're going to pay you a trailer. So they started paying me 1/12 of 1% per month on the $5 million I had in there. 1% of $5 million, I think, is $50,000, isn't it? And so all of a sudden I had something to pay my phone bill with. And over time, I ended up with 25, 30 million. And all I was doing is teaching them about dollar cost averaging. You know? And I, my business was life insurance. I'm a life insurance salesman. But I know this. You need saving, investment, and insurance, don't you? And so I wanted to teach young people, hey, even though you don't have a lot of money, you can. This is designed for the small investor. And small investors can get excited about it. Does that make sense? Try it. Show people. Get a piece of paper. Well, anyway, if once I showed them dollar cost averaging, everybody I ever showed it to got interested in it. And I'd say, now that you've seen dollar cost averaging, how much you think you might be able to put in a month? Well, since I showed $200 a month, what do you think they said? I had one guy say $1,500 a month. I said, man, I don't know if we can handle that. But the thing that I said to them, if they whatever they told me, I could put in $200 a month, whatever it was, I said, now that you've decided to put this $200 a month into this mutual fund, let me ask you a question. If your income would stop, would you want this investment to continue? What do you think they said? What they said was, can you do that? In other words, I was selling waiver premium on a mutual fund. It was a disability policy, right? And then I would say to them, this $200 a month you're setting aside, how much do you think you might want to accumulate someday in your dream, when you're dreaming about it, how much would you like to accumulate for down the road? And they'd say, $250,000 or $500,000. And I'd say, well, why don't we write a little insurance contract here so if you're taken out of the picture, your family will have the $500,000 immediately, just like that. So if you get disabled, we'll put the $200 in for you. If you're taken out of the picture, we'll give your family $500,000. Does that make sense? And that's self-completion. A complete investment plan has a provision for the loss of income due to death or disability. You see, what I'm supposed to be talking to you about here this morning is about our product. But products are used to solve problems, aren't they? Okay, if you're going to have an investment plan, what's the problem? What happens if your income stops? Would you like your investment to continue? You know, that's a great question I found out by accident. Because investment people don't ask that question. And insurance people aren't talking to people about investments. So I talk to them about dollar cost averaging, and then when we get done talking about investing over a long period of time for their future, I'd say to them, well, now that you've decided to put this money in this investment, if your income were to stop, What's the key word here? Income, right? If your income was to stop, would you want this investment to continue? Then I'd show them this page. The complete investment plan has two components. An insurance side, and say this with me, guarantees that if your income, come on you guys, guarantees that if your income stops, the investment continues. And an accumulation side, growth funds, mutual funds, savings. Does that make sense? Now for you young guys, I would copy this page. I'd have 10 of these in my folder. And if I could get 3 minutes with somebody, I showed them that. And I'd hand it to them and they'd keep it. Is that a picture? Is it a story? Let me tell you a story. It creates something in people's minds, gives them something to think about. Also, from an investment point of view, would you like to make the investment thing a little bit easier if you're a life insurance agent? Well, I sure wanted to. And so I told people, I'm in the blue box business. I said, let me show you something. Red box business is based on emotion, hot tips, past performance. Blue box investing is a philosophy, a process where people are employed. In the red box investing, it's called retail investing. Individual positions, concentration in a few securities or a few mutual funds. It's reward-oriented. Short-term measures are employed. You sell on the dips. It's emotional. Blue box, on the other hand, is institutional investing. Very large portfolios. Tremendous diversification. Risk management principles are employed. It has a long-term focus. You buy on the dips, it's disciplined. Then I would take my pencil and I'd make an X over the red box and I would say to them, I'm not in the red box business. I'm in the blue box business. If you want to invest with me, think about your long-term serious money. That's what I'm interested in. And you know what? I had all kinds of people respond to that. I had one fellow once say, Dan, I'm going to give you $150,000 to put in the blue box. And I'm also going to give you $100,000 to put in the red box. And I want you to buy Microsoft and Intel with the red box. Guess what I told him? What I said to him, I'm not in the red box business. I don't want people to get confused that I'm a trader, because I'm not. I'm a life insurance guy who believes in the long term, and I believe in planning and discipline. And so I took the $150,000. Guess what? 5 years later, he called me on the phone and he says, I'm moving my red box money over to your blue box. Incidentally, does this tell you what mutual fund or... It's just a picture, isn't it? All the CPAs and tax attorneys in my neighborhood at one time or another have sent people over to me, and I get a phone call that kind of goes like this. Mr. Corrigan, my name is John Smith, and I was talking to my accountant the other day, and he says I ought to see you about a blue box. It's a true story. You see, we make things far too complicated for people, and it makes them really uncomfortable. If we can make it simple and help them sit down with a plan, I mean, where it becomes a little bit more complicated is when we take the time to record everything about their life and figure out, if I was your financial doctor, what would I do? And in order to know that, I've got to run some lab tests and I've got to do some x-rays. I've got to figure out what you look like and where it is you want to go and figure out a plan to help you get there. But before we do that, I better give you some pictures of some ideas that you can dream a little bit about, so that you feel comfortable with me. Do these kind of pictures give you a good gut feeling? Hello? Do they? What do you think they do for the people that you show them to? I mean, what happens when people have a good gut feeling rather than the feeling of ambivalence? I mean, we're talking about emotion here. When people's emotions, it's a good gut feeling, they trust you. And they're calm about their decision making. They're not nervous. They're not skeptic. Anyway, you guys saw this yesterday, so we won't do that. We did talk yesterday about feeding lane. You know, when you tell somebody you're in the blue box business and you're not in the red box business, what you're doing is you're establishing your feeding.